this share, we consider various halachas related to the ongoing operations of partnerships. There's a major machlokes achronim. If one partner acts in an unauthorized way, he sells property of the partnership without permission, against best practices, against the agreement of the partners, he does something, he takes an action against the interests of the other partners without their permission, and there's a third party involved. He sells property of the partnership to a third party. Is that binding? Can the other partner say, you weren't authorized, we want to reverse this, we want to take the property back? Or can the buyer say, I bought it in good faith, you're a member of the partnership, you acted on behalf of the partnership, so I expect whatever transaction you transacted with me, I expect it to be binding. So this is a major machlokes among the Achronim, the Shach and Choshen Mishpat, and the Beis Hillel and Ibn Ezer, both say that whatever a partner does is binding upon the other partners. Even though the Shach points out, when it comes to a shliach, when it comes to an agent, there is a fundamental rule that a shliach who exceeds his authority, who deviates from his instructions, we say that the principal can say, "Litkunei shdarticha v'lo la'avuse," I sent you to do the correct thing and not to deviate, not to do the wrong thing, not to act against my interest. And therefore, whatever a shliach does, when he exceeds the scope of his authority, we say that it's void. Shutfin are different. When it comes to partners, it's different. The Shach explains, it's for pragmatic reasons. This is the way that shutfin operate. It would be very difficult for partners to do business if the person that they're on the other side of the transaction, if he would have to gain the acquiescence of every single partner, if no transaction is binding and irrevocable unless all the partners sign on, it would be cumbersome and very inconvenient to do business, and that would not be in the best interest of the partners. And therefore, there's a default presumption in the case of partnerships that the partners agree when they go into partnership that whatever any one partner does on behalf of the partnership shall be presumed to be valid, shall be valid, and they won't be able to overturn it. Whether they'll be able to sue, whether they'll have a claim against the partner for acting improperly, whether they can demand compensation from him, that's a separate question. That's something we'll discuss in the next share in Mir Tzeshem. But with respect to outsiders, the Shach and the Beis Hillel hold that whatever the one shutuf does is binding, and the other shutuf cannot overturn it, even if he was not authorized to do what he did. Other Achronim disagree. The Orim V'Tumim, the Nesivos HaMishpat, they say, Lo al zeh nichras bris ha-shutfus, the covenant of partnership was not so expansive, it didn't give one partner the right to act against the interests of the other partners without authorization. So they say there's no such thing, and the shutfin do have the right, the other shutfin do have the right to overturn whatever one shutf did without authorization. Not so clear how we paskin. The Erech Shai says that this is a weak umdana, this umdana that they agree, that they authorize him regardless, is a weak umdana. It depends who's muksuk, if they're still muksuk in the property, the shutfin, or if the seller's muksuk, or if the buyer is muksuk, it will depend where the property is, because it's machlok sachronim, and the svara is debatable, so he says it will depend who's muksuk. The Marsham adds a couple of restrictions, even according to the opinion of the Shach, that what a partner does is binding, even if he exceeds his authorization, his explicit authorization. Marsham says that will not apply in certain cases. He says it depends on, it's an umdana, it's an assumption of what the other partners were willing to grant in advance, how much authority they were willing to grant, beyond that which they explicitly grant him. So he says that if there was an explicit condition that he not do something, then we don't assume that they gave him the power to override that. If they didn't explicitly state one way or another about a certain practice in the partnership agreement, and he does something, even if that's against the Shulchan Aruch, or it's against the Minhag maybe, in such cases we say that what the Shutuf did is binding, and they have to take it up with him, whether he'll compensate them or not. But in a case where there's an explicit agreement that the partnership was not going to take a certain action, and the partner did, then that is not binding, and the other partners have the right to overturn that. Furthermore, he says, this idea that shutfin grant each other this broad authority, even to exceed what they were normally supposed to do, that only applies, he says, to a general partnership, to a partnership for a fixed period of time, or for an indefinite period of time. But since the partnership is broad and they're in business together, we say that they grant each other this type of broad general authorization. But two people who just had a joint venture, they bought a specific property and they're going to sell it and divide the proceeds, they're not actually going into business in a general way for a fixed period of time. They just did one deal together. They bought some property, they're going to unload it and go their separate ways. Such a partnership, he says, it might be called technically a partnership, but in such a partnership, we don't have this rule, even according to the Shach, we don't have this rule that the partners grant each other this broad authorization to exceed exceed what they would normally have the right to do under the rules of partners. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that if a partner provides the partnership with the use of his assets, he lets them use his shop, his warehouse, he lets them use his animal, or perhaps his commercial vehicle, that he makes his assets available to the partnership. Even if he doesn't enter into a formal contract with the partnership, he has the right to demand compensation from the partnership. He takes whatever the fair rental value of his assets were off the top, and the partners then divide the rest as profit and loss, but he first gets to be compensated for whatever of his property he made available to the partnership. Pesach Hashem says that, presumably, it's Pashim, he says, this is only the type of property for which one normally charges rent. Examples I gave of a warehouse or a commercial vehicle, but he says something which is not normally the custom to charge. He lets the partnership use his pen. Maybe he gives the partnership a ride in his personal vehicle, takes a mail to the post office or something like that. Pesach Hashem doesn't give these examples, but in cases where it's not the derech to charge, he says, then he thinks it would be pashut that he has no right to bill this to the partnership. There's another halacha in the same vein in Shulchan Aruch. It says that a shutaf, a partner who provides services, who engages in improvement of partnership property, again, even though he has no contract to do that improvement and to charge for it, but if he does indeed unilaterally, he volunteers and makes certain improvements to partnership property, personal property, real property. Either way, he has the status of a yored. The yored, someone who goes and improves someone else's property without a contract, without an agreement. And he's considered a yored b'reshus. There are different categories of yored. A shutuf is considered a yored b'reshus, who generally has a higher level of compensation. And he can charge the partnership for the work that he did, for the services that he provided. There's a machlokes achronim, whether he is completely like a yored b'reshus, a real yored b'reshus, who is actually authorized, has the right to charge the person whose property he tried to improve, even if he didn't wind up improving it. If he made certain expenditures, unfortunately the improvement didn't happen, or the improvement was worth less than his expenditures, he still has the right to recoup the entirety of his expenditures. That's the halacha in a classic Yared Brishus, and some Achronim understand that that's the halacha. Shmuel argues, this is the opinion of the Rambam, that this is the halacha with regard to partners as well, that if a partner spends money improving partnership property, even though he has no contract, he has the right to charge the partnership for the value of his efforts, the value of his services, just like in the previous case we said he can charge for the use of his property, his warehouse, his vehicles, and so on. Here too we can charge the full value of the services he provided, even if, as long as he did it in good faith, even if the improvement that he hoped to happen didn't happen, or there was no improvement, or the improvement was worth less than the value of his contribution of services, he's considered completely a yared b'reshus, and he can charge the complete value of his contribution. The Ramah disagrees. The Ramah, based on the Mukhe Yosef and other Rishonim, the Ramah says that he's capped, he's limited by actual improvement that occurred. He can't get more than that. The Bishmuel challenges that. So that's Machlok Sekron. He's definitely a yared. He definitely gets some compensation for his services, whether it's the full value of his services, regardless of whether there's any improvement, whether he's limited by the improvement, the maximum is the amount of improvement, that's machlokes achron. But it's clear that just like he can charge for the use of his store, the use of his animal, the use of his warehouse, and so on, it's clear that he can charge for services that he provided as well. There is a problematic ruling of the Nesivus. The Nesivus HaMishpat rules that in general, if one shutuf decides to, Nesivus elsewhere, not commenting on the Salacha, but the Nesivus elsewhere writes that if one partner decides to be tareach, to engage in effort and work on behalf of the partnership, he has no right to charge the partnership for his efforts. He says, because the other partner can say, had you told me, I would have worked also. I don't want to pay you for it. I would have been happy to do the work myself. And therefore, he says, he should have told him, and the other partner can say, I would have done it had you told me. And therefore, a partner is not entitled to charge the partnership for work that he engages in on behalf of the partnership. It's very hard to understand how this is different from the case of Yared. Nesivus himself acknowledges that this is different from the case of a partner who makes his shop or his animal available. He says services and work is different, but he doesn't acknowledge that the halacha of Yared seems to imply that a shutuf is like a Yared. That seems to imply that he can charge even for his work. So this is hard to understand. that there is a Chavos Yair who also seems to say, like the Nesivos, that a partner is not allowed to charge for work and effort that he contributes to the partnership. Rechem Emden struggles with this. Rechem Emden has numerous questions, including the one we just mentioned, how is this different from a Yared? So the Nesivos' position is hard to understand. The Nesivos and the Chavos Yair say that partners cannot generally charge for work they provide, again, unless in a case where the Nesivos agrees, and that the Nesivos says the reason he can't normally charge is because the other partner can say, you should have told me and I would have done it. In a case where the other partner could not have done the work, then the Nesivos seems to agree the partner can charge. Perhaps he understood the holding of Yared is only talking about such a case where the other partner couldn't have done the work himself. But be that as it may, despite the fact that there is a halacha psuka in Shulchan Aruch that a shutef who does work and improves the property, tries to improve the property of the partnership, can charge the partnership as a Yared, nevertheless, there is an opinion of the Chavos Yair and the Nesivos that somehow say that in general, partners who do work cannot charge for the work itself that they do on behalf of the partnership. Maybe they understood the Yared, the charges are for actual expenditures he had, if he planted seeds or so on, but actual personal work and effort that he did, the Nesivos says, then the Chavos Yair say that he can't charge for. The Pesach Hoshen points out that when Rav Yaakov Emden says that he thinks that you could charge, Rav Emden goes back and forth on this question, but he's not 100% sure, but he thinks that you could charge for this. He says, particularly if the work was difficult, kveda or bezuya, it was unpleasant work, it was humiliating work, and the Pesach Hoshen suggests that perhaps in such a case, even the Nesivos and Chavos Yair would agree, if the work was not the kind of work that partners would normally do, it was unpleasant work that they would typically hire someone else to do, perhaps all poskim agree that in such a case, a partner who volunteers to provide such work for the partnership does have the right to charge for those contributions, l'kuli alma, even according to the Nesivos and Chavos Yair. There's a Gemara in Bava Kamma. The Gemara says that if partnership assets are in danger, they've already been seized by bandits, they're in danger. So the halacha is, if one shutef saves some of the assets, if he saves all of them, great, then they saved all the assets. If he only saves some of the assets, so let's say, for example, there are two partners, each one contributed 50, there's a total of 100 in assets, one partner saves them from bandits, but only saves 50, so he says, I saved my share, I want to keep this 50 for my own share. Other partner says, you saved it for the partnership, and now we'll split whatever's left, 50-50. So the Gemara brings a price, the Gemara says, that normally we say hitzilamza, that whatever the shutef did is credited to the partnership as a whole, and he gets only his share of it. But if he said la'atzmi ani matzil ani atzil la'atzmi, if he says I'm doing this, if he declares at the time he engaged in the effort to save the property, I'm doing this on my own behalf, then he keeps whatever he saved. The Gemara explains that when it comes to shutfin, there is normally a presumption of dedication. As long as he's a partner, we typically assume that whatever he did, he did so on behalf of the partners. So if he's a partner in an ongoing partnership, we interpret his action as being on behalf of the partnership, and therefore he has to split whatever he saved with the other partners. However, if he says, ani atzil atzmi, I'm doing this myself, a shutef in such a case has the right to make a unilateral division of the partnership. Normally you have to notify the other partner that you want to divide, that you want to dissolve the partnership, but here it's an emergency, you're on the spot. Here you can make an emergency unilateral dissolution, then you're not a partner, and then you're saying that you're saving it for yourself. That's how we paskin, that if a shutef, whatever a shutef does, is presumed to be on behalf of the other shutefin as well, unless he declares at the time, I'm doing this, I'm saving the property on my own behalf. There's machlokes achronim, whether this declaration, the Gemara says, I'm amar ani atzil atzmi, if he says, I'm saving it for myself. So what does amar mean? Does he have to say it verbally? So the Beis Yosef and the Marshal say you have to say it verbally. The Bach says that it is sufficient to intend it. If the other partner is around, you have to make a verbal declaration so he should know about it. But if nobody's around, what's the point of making verbal statements if nobody's going to hear them? Then you can do it even if that's your intent, then you can do it even without verbalizing it. Beis Yosef says it has to be verbal. One of his arguments is we have a general principle, dvarm shebelev lo avi dvarm. When a person thinks something but doesn't verbalize it, doesn't state it out loud, it doesn't have halachic validity. So the Beis Yosef says it has to be said out loud. But the Bach says it only has to be said out loud. Bach doesn't discuss Dvarim Shebelev, but he says it only has to be said out loud if there's someone to hear it. Otherwise, it's pointless, and then even a mental, internal declaration is sufficient. The Maras Sasson, Rav Aaron Sasson, as interpreted at least by the Machne Ephraim, says that this whole din, that if a shutif saves the asset, if a shutif saves the asset to the shutfus, unless he made the declaration of la'atzmi ani matzil, then he has to share it. That's only if he saved the actual assets of the partnership, as in the case of the Gemara, where the property was being stolen by bandits and he retrieved it. Or, like, perhaps if he saved, if he put out a fire and saved, and if he rescued some of the assets of the property, of the partnership, from a fire. But Maras HaSon says, if instead of being able to save the actual assets, he merely managed to secure some kind of compensation, maybe insurance or some other kind of compensation for some of the property, then he says, that's pashut, he says, that's his own. That's not the property, that's not partnership assets. That's something else, that's compensation. And that, if he, that, even though he's a partner, we say that, that he only saved, that he only, that, that whatever he saved, he can keep up to it until he receives his share. Nachman Frank discusses whether this is correct or not, but this is how he understands the tshuva of the Toras Emes, Rav Aharon Sasson. How are shutfin, how are partners supposed to behave? What are the rules that govern how partners are supposed to operate while the partnership is in effect? So the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, bring a rule. Partners are expected to act kaminag hamedina, the standard prevailing commercial custom. They're supposed to act the way businessmen act in this area with regard to this kind of property. The Rambam and Shulchan Aruch give a number of examples. You shouldn't travel away from the initial location. You shouldn't extend credit, except for a context, a type of transaction in which credit, in type of merchandise in which credit is usually extended, and so on. So he gives a number of specific examples, and in general he says partners have a responsibility to behave according to minhag hamedina. They're supposed to respect the, they're supposed to act in accordance with prevailing custom. There's a major machlokes achronim, there's a major discussion of achronim, beginning in the 16th century among the Sardin for centuries, about does a partner have a defense? A shliach, they talk about an agent or a partner. Do they have, is there a defense if a shliach deviates, if a partner deviates from what he's supposed to do, deviates from the minhag, deviates from his instructions, and he says, I didn't do what I was normally supposed to do, but I was the man on the spot. This is before they had phones and computers. I couldn't contact you. And my judgment was that in the circumstances in which I found myself, I thought this was your, in your best interest. It turned out it wasn't. It turned out things went south and money was lost. But I thought, I truly believed this was in your best interest. So assuming Beistin actually believes that, assuming that's credible, is that a valid defense? Can he say the halachas are the default, but I couldn't contact you, and in the circumstances in which I found myself, I thought this was the best thing to do. The general consensus of the Sephardic postum is that it's not a good defense, that if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're considered a mishane or a pasheya. We'll discuss next week. Next week's share, we'll discuss the halachas of someone who is mishane or pasheya, who deviates or is negligent. But most postum say that in general, the claim that I meant well, that I had good intentions, is not a sufficient defense against the charge that he was mishane or pasheya. There are some opinions that say that it is a good defense. Even those opinions are talking about an onus, like if it was stolen or lost at sea. Even they agree that the Gemara says you'll still be responsible if the business doesn't work out as well as you thought it would. Moreover, there are some achronim who distinguish between the case where you actively deviated as opposed to passively deviated, where you actually bought the wrong thing or you put it in the wrong warehouse or put it on the wrong ship, in which case there's no defense that you meant well, as opposed to a passive case where he simply declined to follow an instruction he was given. But in general, the post can say that the defense that I meant well is not a good defense. You're expected to act according to the minhag, according to the halachos, according to any agreement you have, and you're not supposed to make it up as you go along, even if you truly, honestly believe that that's in the best interest of the partnership. But what do we do? What do we do in a case where there's a situation arises where there's no clear agreement, and the partners are discussing what they should do? How do partners resolve a difference of opinion? What do they do in cases where they're not covered by the initial agreement? So surprisingly, perhaps, this question is not really discussed by the classic poskim. We have a couple of relatively recent discussions, one from a century and a half ago, probably Ezra Gordon of Tells, and one contemporary discussion by Rav Mendel Shafran of Eretz Yisrael. Eliezer Gordon says that, in general, we follow the opinion of Rove of the partners. If the partners can't agree, and Rove say one way, and a miut, the minority, say the other way, we follow the Rove. He says it's true that if we consult experts, if we ask for a professional outside opinion, and the professional's opinion is different from the Rove, he sides with the miut, Then we'll follow the mute, he says. I mean, if all the shutim want to disregard the experts, that's their prerogative. Obviously, they don't have to listen to the expert. But if even one shutif sides with the experts, the expert sides with one shutif, we follow him because we don't follow Rove against what we've established to be expert opinion. However, he says, Beis Din normally will not ask an expert. If Beis Din sees that partners are disagreeing, Beis Din will tell them, follow what Rove partners say. Why? So Rav Gordon explains that the Shutfin are not worse than any other experts, even though they are worse in the sense that if we ask outside experts, we follow them against the partners. But as long as you haven't consulted outside experts, he says, you follow the Rove. Don't tell me, he says, they're no Gebedover, they're interested parties, and we don't care about what they say. Yeah, they're interested parties. Their interest is the best interest of the partnership. So their interest, Adam Smith's invisible hand, their interest dovetail beautifully, their personal interest dovetail perfectly with the partnership interest. So we follow the Rove because we assume that what the Rove wants is indeed in the best interest of the partnership. Rav Shafran has a somewhat different perspective. He agrees that halacha lemaisa, in many cases, we will follow the Rove. He says the first rule is that in general, the partners, companies, businesses will have an agreement. When they form the business, they'll have some kind of agreement about how differences of opinion shall be resolved. And whatever the agreement is, that's what you follow. He says, commonly, when we're dealing with companies, with corporations, the agreement will be to follow Rove, that you take votes and you follow what most of the shareholders want. There are different classes of shareholders, he says. There are voting shares and non-voting shares. But in general, you follow the Rove. Certain types of particularly momentous decisions, a supermajority is required, 60% or 75%. But in general, there'll be an agreement. The agreement will typically say to follow the Rove. And if there is such an agreement, then you certainly follow whatever the agreement says. Moreover, Rav Shafran adds, even if there is no agreement, he says, even if the agreement inexplicably left out the rules for what to do to resolve differences, you still follow the Rove in the context of a company, of a corporation, because, he says, they probably meant to write that. They left it out, but it's usually written, so we assume that they probably wanted their business to be run on the same pattern that other businesses are run. Don't say, because they left it out, that itself should serve as reason to believe that they dafka don't want the standard arrangement. You see, not like that, he says. You see, we have a rule, achrayas ta'as sofer, that the halacha is that when, Gemara has machlokes about it, but achrayas ta'as sofer means that when most documents of a certain kind contain achrayas, liability, that the person accepts responsibility if the field is taken, he ensures the buyer against loss, he guarantees it'll make him whole. Normally they would write that, that's called achrayas. Achrayas tosofer means if one shtar doesn't contain that clause, we don't say, oh, the fact that they left it out means they don't want there to be achrayas. On the contrary, we say we assume that they want what everyone else wants, what most people want in these circumstances. The fact that he left it out is a tosofer, it's a mistake, they forgot to write it in. Here too, Rav Shafran says, If they didn't write that we follow the majority, we assume they want the standard conventional arrangement, and they simply forgot to write it. We do find the opposite svar in halacha as well. In the beginning of our discussion of partnerships, we mentioned the pinning of the rush, that the reason when you have two partners who contribute unequal amounts to the partnership, and then there are profits, the halacha is they split it 50-50. The Rishonim give various reasons why. The Rush says the reason why is because Shutfin normally would stipulate that they want the profits to be split in proportion to the capital that they contribute. If they didn't stipulate that, the conspicuous absence of such a stipulation indicates that they want the profits to be split 50-50. So the Rush makes exactly this argument, that if something is typically spelled out explicitly, and here it was not, we assume they want something different. Or Rav Shafran here says that we would rather follow the rule of achrayas to sofer. We would rather assume that the omission of the standard follow the majority clause was inadvertent and they meant it, and we follow the majority. Rav Shafran continues, and he says that the certain decisions are the prerogative of the CEO, the mankal, that certain normal decisions within the normal operation of the company, the partners leave, the shareholders leave to the executives. Now, obviously, he says the executive is not the boss. He's not in charge. I mean, he is the boss, but only because they appointed him the boss. But certainly, he says, shareholders have the right to strip him of his power. They have the right to take authority away from him and to override his decisions. That's all true, because he's simply their representative, their appointee. That's how companies work. But as long as they don't object, he says, then they can delegate certain decisions to him, and the decisions he makes will be binding. However, he says, this is all if there is an agreement, or if there is an agreement to follow Rove, or in a corporate context, where this is how companies normally work. But in other kinds of partnership, he says, we have private individuals who jointly purchase a lot and plan to develop it and build homes, build apartments. This is not a business, a company. This is just an individual one-off venture. Then there's no general custom, he says, to follow Rove. So we don't follow Rove. Unlike Rav Gordon, who seems to feel that Rove is an inherent halachic rule, that that's how partnerships resolve differences, Rav Shafran seems to feel that that you follow Rove only because that's the minhag. He brings, the Rama brings, Rama Rottenberg rule that communities follow Rove. If communities can't reach consensus, unanimous consensus on communal decisions, they follow Rove. But he says that again, that could do with the minhag. The minhag was they follow the Rove. But if there's no minhag, like in a private venture, it's not a company, it's not a business, you don't follow Rove, he says. And you're stuck by, and you simply have to abide by the initial agreement, whatever it was. No partner, no group of partners, even Rove partners, can force the partnership to deviate from its initial agreement, unless they all agree. Because the same way I can't force you to sell your property against your will, no group of partners, even if they form a majority, can force any individual partner or minority group of partners to sell their property or to act with regard to their property against their will. So what do you do if you have to make, so you can stay in the status quo, as long as the status quo is viable, unless they all agree, you have to remain with the status quo. What if there is no status quo? What if a decision has to be made? There's a business that lost its lease, they have to sign a new lease, they need new premises, there are two options, and the partners can't agree. And we're dealing with a case, again, where we're not going to follow the Rove, there's no agreement to follow Rove, the partners can't agree, there is no status quo, so what do you do? So Rav Shafran says, if there is, again, professional opinion, like Rav Gordon, he says, we consult experts, and if experts tell us this option is a business-wise a better option than that one, you follow that one, because agreements of partnerships, the assumption is that professional opinion should play a role in deciding what to do. If, however, there's no clear professional preference, you ask experts, they say these are both viable options, it can go either way, and they can't reach consensus, so what do you do? So in such a case, Rav Shafran says, we do garul. That's what, we make a lottery. That's what Chazal said when partners are trying, when, let's say, brothers, partners are trying to divide property and they can't agree who should get which field or which building or whatever it is. If they can't agree, you do a garul. That's the only fair way to resolve the deadlock. And here too, Rav Shafran says, if partners can't agree, even in an ongoing partnership, if there are two courses of action and they simply can't reach a consensus on which one to adopt, then the halacha is that we perform a garul to decide which course of action to adopt.